and you're listening to It's All About Food. It's May 16, 2012, and in the next hour we get to talk about my favorite subject, food, and it has so many impacts on our everyday life here on planet Earth. Food. Who would think that every morsel we put in our mouth makes a difference? And it could be a good, positive thing, or a not-so-good thing. That's what we talk about here. And what I try and do is offer up lots of interesting information from authors, chefs, doctors, nutritionists, athletes, and just people who are interested in food and its impacts on health, environment, and the treatment of animals. And I learn a lot here. I hope you do, too. There are lots of different ways to look at food. Certainly the most obvious is, how does food nourish our bodies? Does it nourish our bodies? And there are lots of issues related to food. Do we have enough food? Do we have too much food? Do we have too little food? And then, of course, how does the food get to our plates? It's such a fascinating, complicated issue, and I don't do it enough, but I encourage everyone from time to time, if only on Thanksgiving Day or on other days during the year, think about what you're eating and where it came from. It's a long, complicated story, from seed to growing the plant, the people involved in growing and harvesting, the people involved in packaging and transporting. And then, of course, if you choose to eat animal products, which we don't really promote on this show, there's a lot of things that go on there that are not really very pleasant. And they affect the environment and all life on Earth. Okay, so we got some fun things to talk about today. And my first guest is Ruby Roth. She's an artist, designer, writer living in Los Angeles. She's vegan since 2003 and was teaching art in an after-school program when the children's interest in healthy foods and veganism first inspired her to write her first acclaimed book, That's Why We Don't Eat Animals, which gained international attention and garnered multiple translations. Well, she's got a new book, Vegan is Love, Having Heart and Taking Action, and it came out last month, just in time for Earth Day. And she notes, every day is Earth Day when you're vegan. I really agree with that. Complementing her degrees in art and American studies, Ruby Roth has researched animal agriculture, health, nutrition, and the benefits of a plant-based diet for nearly a decade. She continues to share her special brand of gentle candor as a vegan consultant and speaker. Ruby, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you. Nice to speak with you again.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this next half hour. I like the way you put it in your bio, gentle candor.
Thank you.
That's what it's all about, gentle candor, and you really do that so well.
Thank you. It's really about making this information manageable for a child's capacity without sugarcoating or avoiding the truth.
This seems to be such a really difficult issue. So one of the things that I say very often is, don't read your press, weigh it. And I think you've been getting a bit of attention, some of it positive and some of it negative. I watched your interview, what was it, on Fox News, I think?
Uh-huh. And with the child psychologist?
Yes. You know, how does
that,
you know... I just want to take a step back here and say, what do they call a doctor who graduates in the last of his class?
What's that?
A doctor.
Yeah.
You don't have to be that great a student. You know, you can be the last in your class. It doesn't mean you know everything. And then there are some that do quite well and know a lot, and yet they've got these blinders on and don't want to see the truth. And when I saw that interview with this psychologist who clearly was clueless.
Yeah, I'm positive he didn't even see the book.
And probably didn't
see
the book. Yes. Well, you looked really, really lovely on that show, by the way.
It went exactly as I planned.
Well, one of the things that I liked, where can people see that, by the way?
I have links to it on my website, wedonteatanimals.com.
Wedonteatanimals.com. I definitely recommend checking that out because it is educational and amusing.
And I mean, I think the most fascinating part of this whole controversy and outrage about the book is that by calling it controversial, we're admitting on a national level that what we do to animals is scary, too scary to even talk about with our kids. So to me, that says people know, but they want to remain willfully ignorant and impose that ignorance on their children. And I think that the path to a greener future relies on engaging a new generation in learning how to eat healthfully and consciously.
What I love about this book, you know, I don't think it's necessarily for only children. This is a book
Yes.
for everyone. It is simply just a few more than 20 pages. It's beautifully illustrated, and you use very little language to convey a lot of difficult things that are going on today, and for anyone to read it and not get it.
Thank you. Our motto about the book is so easy, even adults can understand.
That's
it's
right.
It's a really basic introduction to what's going on and how our choices on a daily basis affect the public realm. And at its core, it's really about democracy, supply and demand, and engaging ourselves in the public realm.
So a lot of people, they don't have time, and they're not, well, I think people just don't want to know, because once they know, then they realize they're culpable, and then what do?
Well, there's a lot of fear around veganism for people who are unfamiliar with it or don't realize that nations of people throughout history have thrived and survived on plant-based diets. So I understand the questions that come up, but at this point in time, there are answers to any question anybody may have.
You know, you bring up an important word, fear. And, you know, the older I get, the more I realize how many people are operating or reacting to some amount of fear that they have in their lives. And I want to say it's really scary. I'm not someone who has a lot of fear, but I know more and more people that do. And as a result, they just act in very, very strange ways. And that's why it's so important when a child is young to empower them with information, let them know the truth. Because when you find out the truth later, after you know you've been lied to and covered up to, I think it really takes away a strong foundation or a shaky foundation, makes the foundation shaky.
Well, we spend years and years of our youth being indoctrinated with the normalization of eating meat and dairy. So when you tell an adult who's unfamiliar with veganism and its history that we should abandon the standard American diet, that seems unheard of for many people. It's also important for people to realize that when we talk about veganism, we're not talking about the standard American diet minus meat and dairy. We are talking about a different pyramid whose nutrients are more dense, they're more bioavailable, and they come free from the harmful side effects that we see meat and dairy causing. I mean, studies continue to show the link between consuming animal products and chronic disease, and I think that any teacher in a school across America can tell you that their kids are showing signs of lack of nutrition, whether it's lack of energy or the inability to concentrate or temper tantrums, or everyone has ADD now. Mm-hmm. I think that a transition to a better diet would help everybody across the board.
I'm sure this drives you nuts because it drives me nuts. I forget where it was, but it was some mother's blog site that was mentioning your book and her concerns with it. And something that you read over and over again, a vegan diet can be nutritious, but it has to be well planned, and the parents have to monitor and make sure the child's eating the right food. And yet, can we just leave out vegan and just say diet? Because most kids today just eat junk. And why aren't people saying that, well, what about your children? They're not vegan, but they're not eating anything nutritious.
Right. Well, we are simply changing the repertoire of what we eat. It's not any more difficult. It's not any more scary. And any responsible parent will look into the proper ways to transition and really find out what it means to be a vegan, not just, you know, eliminate meat and dairy from the standard American.
Right. Now, you have a daughter?
A stepdaughter, yes.
And how old is she?
She is seven. She was born and raised vegan.
Right. And what does she think of your latest book?
She loves it. She was part of the process, and we had a lot of conversations throughout the whole thing. I bounced a lot of ideas off of her and asked her questions and for her thoughts. It's completely normalized in our household, and she's very strong in her veganism, and I haven't seen her be swayed by anybody.
Right. And
she's also, let me just mention for people who have questions, she's in the top percentiles of growth and mental development. So no issues there. She's very healthy.
Well, that's good to hear, and I'm not surprised to hear it either. okay, so there's some really lovely artwork in your book.
Thank you.
And it's, what do they say, a picture tells a thousand words, things like that. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking at the one on the page about zoos, and so you have a large cell, I guess. Mm-hmm. What would you call it? It's kind of with the people.
Enclosure.
Yeah, the shadow of the people on top looking down. Very powerful and yet so simple.
Yeah, the giraffe enclosure.
Yeah. And now, of course, you go beyond food here and talk and simply show in the book how we exploit animals for so many things, racing, hunting, bullfights and rodeos. And the circus is one place. I mean, those of us who know and research or just look into what goes on behind the circuses, the ones like Ringling Brother who have animals and elephants and really treat them so poorly. And then other circuses like Cirque du Soleil can be just as entertaining, if not more so, and you see the incredible things that humans with free choice can do with their bodies.
Exactly, and I think when we give kids the information they need to make educated choices, then they choose wisely. And I think if any kid knows what their participation in the zoo or circus really means, the animal circuses, then they'd be happy to go see a show where we know the creatures love to perform, like people in Cirque du Soleil.
I think you're really breaking some ground with your books.
Thank you.
I'm wondering, outside of the vegan community, what kind of feedback have you gotten?
It's been interesting because I've heard from a broad range of people, from military men to militant vegans and moms and just people around the world in all different countries. And it's a range of responses from, you know, really intense hate mail to meat eaters who saw the Fox interview and just were ashamed by Fox's presentation. People who are intrigued by the conversation and have thought a little bit about cutting down on meat and dairy, but something I've said has sparked further interest. So I'm thrilled that there's a conversation happening, whether there's opposition or support. When I was a little kid, I don't think the word vegan was in existence in my community. And now, relatively short time later, we know enough about it to argue, you know, so
right.
I think that's a big step, you know, that people are aware of the word and we're planting seeds.
Well, I remember the books that I read as a child, and I'm sure that children, many children are still reading similar books, although I think on the whole children's books have gotten a lot more creative and a lot better at sharing some really important messages. But, you know, we still have that notion that old MacDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I-O, and, there, you know, the animals are out there grazing, and we take care of them, and it's like a family affair, and they give us milk and eggs, and there's, I don't remember much the story about slaughtering them and eating them later, but,
Yeah. That's a very powerful image in, I think, all of America's mind.
Mm-hmm.
The happy cow, the happy farmer, the happy field. And when we question that, and you only need to scratch the surface of that to find the corruption and the destruction that we are inflicting not only on animals, but the environment. In the land on which we raise these animals and how our choices affect people across the world. You know, we're raising 65 billion animals around the world every year and feeding them grain instead of the 1 billion people in the world who are starving. So there's a lot to learn in all of these issues to replace, you know, this idyllic idea we have with the truth.
Yeah. Now, one of the, I remember talking, I think it was to Sandra Steingraber, who writes about environmental issues, and she talked about how she likes to explain what's going on with the environment, the good things, the bad things, to her children, and then explains what she's doing to help make a difference. And she said that rather than scaring the children, knowing that there are problems in the world, she was actually empowering them, letting them know that there are adults out there that are working towards handling the problem, and that when they get older, they can do their part to solve the problems. And
exactly, and that's a point that has been left out on my TV appearances, that every page on this book has a positive affirmation about action we can take. And that is the reason that children are not afraid of this book, and it's not scary for them, because the most important lesson is that we don't have to fear anything that we have the power to change. And I believe that we don't have to wait to grow older to exert that power. My book is about things anybody and everybody can do on a daily basis, from our food to our clothing to the way we spend our dollars and what we choose as entertainment.
Amen. But, you know, there are a lot of kids that are living in fear, and that word fear again comes up because they grow up and they still have this fear, and it affects them in so many negative ways as adults. And so it is so important to empower kids to know, yeah, life is challenging, there's going to be problems, but you are going to be a part of the solution. Go out and do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by avoiding the truth or sugarcoating it, I think we're actually hindering what our children are capable of and hindering our own progression for a greener and more sustainable society.
Right. And another aggravating thing, you said this book, or I read this book, came out around Earth Day, April 22nd, which happens to be my birthday. Something to celebrate. And it always frustrates me on Earth Day, because we see all these recommendations, especially geared towards kids, because it's a good opportunity to have something to engage children, and the projects that are recommended from websites and in schools, and the things that they recommend aren't bad, but they're not the really most important issues.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. I see so many books that tell kids have positive messages about you can change the world and you can be anything you want to be. But even with a lot of these green programs, they're leaving out food and a plant-based diet, or at least moving towards a plant-based diet. And by leaving that out, we are leaving out the most far-reaching, impactful thing that any one person can do. Because by making vegan choices, we can reach every major industry and every corner of the earth. That's a lot more effective than talking about turning off light switches and flipping off the faucet while we brush.
That's right. The thing that I'm kind of harping on these days is the powerful impact of marketing and advertising on what we choose to eat. Our eating trends definitely reflect our advertising trends, and it's criminal that over $11 billion is going into food and beverage and restaurant and junk food advertising, and two orders of magnitude less goes into healthy food.
So I mean, 75% of government subsidies go to meat and dairy, while less than 0.5% goes to fruits and vegetables. So when people talk about my book as being brainwashing and propaganda, we need to look at who's really in charge and who's really propagating a given doctrine about
Absolutely.
What we're eating.
Yeah, people talk about, you know, where we want to tax sodas and take junk food out of schools, and people say we need free choice and we should be able to decide, and they have no idea how subtly they have been manipulated to want foods that are not healthy for them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as soon as you scratch the surface, it's not even subtle. I mean, these are calculated, organized partnerships between our government, the Department of Education, the USDA, pharmaceutical companies, big agriculture. I mean, if people knew the degree of collusion, then the outrage would really be directed at the industries and not at a children's book about alternative choices.
And what about, I know a lot of parents struggle with what their children eat, and it gets harder as they get older. Well, your stepdaughter's 7. That could be. How is she as an eater?
Oh, she's great. She's, I mean, we're on a plant-based diet of a lot of raw foods and superfoods, and her health is just off the charts. But I think that a lot of parents, meat eaters and whoever, would wish that their kids would eat more fruits and vegetables. And I think that by looking into a plant-based diet and giving kids the information they need to make educated choices, there's a much likelier chance that a child will start eating healthier and be interested if they understand why. And they understand, okay, we're not going to eat junk food. Here's the reasons why, and these are the better choices. So there was a meat-eating mother who wrote to me and said her child is picky enough, and if they were to come in contact with my book at school, it would just drive her over the top. And my answer was really that coming into contact with the idea of veganism might help her child eat better.
Mm-hmm.
It might have a positive influence on getting this kid to eat more fruits and vegetables.
Well, one of the problems, and it's a big problem, is the parents themselves are not good eaters. They've been totally marketed and influenced, and many people don't know where their kitchens are. They don't know how to make healthy food. They're kind of all overwhelmed in their schedules with work and taking care of their kids, and they want what they think is convenient, even though they don't realize that preparing simple foods can be easier and more convenient. And so sometimes kids come home and say, I want to eat these foods, and the parents are so overwhelmed because they don't know what to do.
Right, and I think that's an honest fear, and I understand that. If a kid comes home saying they want to eat healthier and the parent just doesn't know what to make, that can be overwhelming, but the change doesn't have to come overnight. And the transition, when we focus on all that can be gained from veganism and a plant-based lifestyle, from health to the environment to our politics, and the transition is really joyful. not overwhelming.
Have you had an opportunity to turn around a really angry person and have them see your side?
You know, I don't really engage the hate mail that comes through because I think it's coming from such a different place. And over email, I just can't deal with it. But if someone has serious inquiries and really wants to know and has an interesting question, of course, I think most people just need the facts and need to be turned on to something that they can witness with their own eyes to be able to understand where I'm coming from.
Right. Well, and where do people find your book? So, because, you know, some people find it and then discover that it's not what they expected it to be.
It's everywhere where books are sold internationally. It's in many libraries as well, so people can request their librarian to bring it in if they don't want to commit.
Right. Well, I would love to see it in all schools and all libraries, and I think it should be required reading for all adults.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any plans for another book after this one?
I do have more plans. I have some ideas brewing, so people should stay tuned.
So there's more loving stuff out there that's going to piss people off.
Yes, I plan on lots of it.
What's amazing is that just the crazy, ironic contrast, especially during that program on Fox News. But if they see you and hear your gentle voice and look at you and see how lovely you are, and you just want to spread the love, and people's blood is boiling, it's just the most comical, crazy contrast.
It is, and I hope that most people realize that when they're talking to a passionate vegan, what they might call self-righteousness is actually just an urgency we feel to take care of everybody and look at the well-being of all people, including the people that we're talking to. So, you know, I wish everybody that I talk to the best, and just find the joy in spreading my message.
Okay. So what's the website, again, that people can find more about you and your book?
It is WeDon'tEatAnimals.com, and from there they can get to my Facebook and Twitter and my blog, where we write about all kinds of stuff, from politics to food to animals. So it's a good resource for anybody.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking to me. Thank you for writing this book, and thank you for being a strong warrior. I don't know that warrior is the right word. A peaceful warrior,
I like it. I'll
at
take
least.
It.
Peaceful one, spreading such an important message. Love. Vegan is love. Read the book. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm Karen Hartglass, and please visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. If you're wondering how to do this crazy vegan thing, there's lots of information there for you. And we will be right back, and we're going to be talking about white bread with Aaron Bobrow-Strain. Stay with us. Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. You know, it seems that every kind of food that we eat has its own story. It surprises me sometimes, but, you know, we've learned about a number of different individual food items, about tomatoes. There have been all kinds of stories about how our farming practices of individual kinds of fruits and vegetables. Well, today, It's the wheat story. We're going to be talking about wheat and white bread. And my guest is Aaron Bobrow-Strain, who's the author of the new book, White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. He's an associate professor of politics at Whitman College, writes and teaches on the politics of the global food system. He's the author of Intimate Enemies, Landowners, Power, and Violence in Chiapas. I don't think I pronounced that correctly. Anyway, please welcome Aaron Bobrow-Strain. How do you say that?
Thanks for having me. It's Chiapas.
Chiapas.
It's the southernmost state of Mexico.
You know, I had it in my brain, and it wasn't coming out of my mouth. Okay, Chiapas, yes. I've heard it, but I guess I've never really focused on how it's spelled. Mm-hmm. There we go. So much for my Spanish. Welcome to It's All About Food, and
yeah,
love your book, and I'm really looking forward to talking about it in the next half hour.
Mm-hmm.
It's always fascinating to me to read about food. There's so much intrigue and scandal and stories, something like the staff of life that we've been depending on for so long. Wheat bread has such an interesting story.
It sure does, yeah. I mean, when I started this project, I had no idea what an important role bread played in the American diet.
Right.
You know, we got on average probably about 30% of daily calorie intake from some form of bread, mostly white bread, from the late 19th century all the way to the mid-1960s, even more during times of war and recession. And no food today comes anywhere close to
that. That was mind-boggling when I read that. I couldn't imagine people really living on that much bread.
Right. Despite the biblical proverb, right, there have been many times in human history when people subsisted on pretty much bread alone. And that's why it becomes so important and so interesting, right? Because it's so essential to so many people's everyday survival, their commensality around the table, you know, how they eat together with people, that it becomes, I call it, one of the country's most fought over foods.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much every social reformer, diet guru, health expert, military war planner, you name it, wanted to change America's bread or its bread habits in some way. So it becomes this really fun, great way to explore our country's long, turbulent, weird love affair with trying to save the world by getting people to eat differently.
Well, I found it fascinating because a lot of what you talk about was during my lifetime. I'm 54 now, and so I lived through a lot of this stuff and was kind of like, my eyes were popping out and I was laughing and all kinds of different things. Like, I had no clue while I was going through it what was really going on.
You lived through the cusp moment, I think, or your
yeah.
early formative years were the cusp moment where industrial white bread goes from being something that builds the body 12 ways, you know, a sign of responsible parenting. It's a good thing to give to your kids. It's a patriotic thing. It's a sign of national strength. To, you know, by the time you were, graduating from college, you know, it had started to become a symbol of poverty and poor choices and
mm-hmm.
ill health.
Yep. And I remember in my college years when the whole wheat, whole grain thing was becoming hip and, well, it was the food of the hippies, but it was also becoming more popular, and that was where I was going. I was more into the whole foods, but I had no idea how the whole white bread scene came about, so it was really fascinating to read about it.
Yeah.
Yes.
What was really striking to me was that all that food counterculture movement that, you know, brought us lines like the whiter your bread, the quicker you're dead in the 1960s, what I was totally unprepared for when I went into researching the book was that all is simply reviving bread controversies that happened much earlier in U.S. history. That line, actually, the whiter your bread, the quicker you're dead, which a lot of people in the 60s counterculture used, was actually taken from a radio health advisor named Dr. Clark, who broadcast in Chicago during the 1920s, another period when there was lots of concern about whether bread was healthy, what kind of bread was healthy, those kinds of questions. So this is a parade perennial thing that comes up over and over again in U.S. history.
One of the things that is very clear to me is that we make a lot of decisions and we learn a lot from available media. And so 100 years ago, whatever it was, people didn't know much about calories and vitamins you wrote about, and yet they started to learn a little bit from government information and from some propaganda material and whatever information was put in front of them. And it really hasn't changed today, except that we're inundated now with television and radio and internet, and people may know a little bit more about nutrition. I think they have some vocabulary words. I don't think they know what they really mean. But it's just interesting how we've learned, and I don't even want to use the word learn, because we're not really learning what's good for us. We're learning what society wants us to eat.
Right. Are we learning more about what makes us healthy, or are we taking in tons more information?
Mm-hmm.
Competing perspectives on that question. And also, it feels sometimes, and this is a story that I trace through the book because it comes out really well in the bread story, is we've kind of gone through a moment where health and our ideas about health have become detached from actual health and have almost become more like a secular religion.
Yes.
Where the pursuit of the perfect body, the perfect outward appearance, regardless of one's internal health, or what one has to do to get that perfect body, whether it's bulimia or obsessive exercising or whatever, that has become a kind of, it's almost become synonymous with moral virtue. And there's a way in which I and some other historians call that the emergence of healthism, this kind of pursuit of health as a secular religion. And there's a lot of questions about whether that actually makes us healthier.
Exactly. I know that I've been accused of sounding rather religious when I've been proselytizing my beliefs about food, but I really promote my point of view of how I feel about healthy food, because I just want people to feel good. I want to eliminate pain and suffering, and I want people to not only look good on the inside, but on the outside.
Right. There's an important lesson there about reconnecting our notions, or reconnecting our ideas about health to actual what makes us healthier, as opposed to what helps us conform to a particular moralized idea of what we should be eating, a particular moralized idea of how our body should look.
So there are a few main points that you brought up in the book. I wanted to touch on some of them. So one of them is this idea about the food availability for the wealthy versus the poor, and how white bread played into that. And we see that continually, even today when I'm talking to people about eating healthy food, many of us are accused of just talking to the privileged, because a lot of people who have compromised financial situations don't really have the opportunity to choose.
Yeah, that's right, and I think that's going to be the big... I wrote this book in many ways, even though it's a history, I'm very much part of what you could call the alternative food movement, right? I'm backyard chicken raising, farmers market shopping, cheese making. I like to pickle things. I worked on a humane, sustainable cattle ranch that I'm now part owner of. So I'm really part of this movement and has been for 20 years. But at the same time, I really started to grow skeptical about a lot of the attitudes and orientations of the movement, particularly the way in which the movement has generally kind of adopted a perspective of, you know, if you only knew what I knew, what I know about how bad your food is, you would change. It's kind of idea that, you know, that I have the truth about your food, and why are you so dumb that you haven't figured this out? Or how can I help you, the less privileged person, figure this out or get access to good food? And I think that there are some good things have come out of that, but it doesn't, for me, do justice to the kind of complex anxieties and aspirations and habits and economic pressures that really determine what we eat. So that's really where this book came from. I was looking around and at what's available out there in terms of information about food, and I was actually quite surprised. You know, I started thinking, well, we don't have enough information about how broken our food system is.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out there are tons of books and articles and documentaries, all kinds of great stuff about how broken our food system is, the high environmental, health, social costs of our food system. And they often kind of give a very simplistic consumer-based solution to that, you know, like vote with your fork, buy local.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really feel satisfying to me. I wanted something a little bit more. I wanted to know how people have tried to change the food system in the past, what they've succeeded at, what they've failed at, you know, what kind of traps they've fallen into. And so white bread turns out to be a great way to look at that because, as I said before, it's this incredibly fought over food. So we can see all these different movements and food gurus. In a way, the book ends up being not so much about bread. It's very much about bread, but it's also really the story of all these different food gurus and social movements and diet experts who felt that, like, if we could just get Americans to eat the right bread.
That's right. The world would be a peaceful, beautiful place.
Everything would be fixed. And I take a really sympathetic approach to this. I have a lot of affection for these food reformers and what they've done, considering myself part of that. But at the same time, I'm very critical of that, if you only knew. And so what I try to do is try to encourage the alternative food movement to take into account the complex anxieties and aspirations that drive our food system. Because as you said, we have a very polarized food system.
Yeah.
That produces really high quality food, mostly for the wealthy, and consuming that helps them feel superior to the rest of the world. And then the food system provides garbage for the rest of us.
Yep.
And the history of battles over white bread, I think, suggests that changing this mess is going to require more than just voting with our forks or, you know, a kind of charity approach that helps, quote-unquote, helps the less privileged gain access to better food. It's going to require focusing on the structures of power, really, that make the food system what it is, basically incredible concentration in big food. Big industrial food is a highly concentrated, highly powerful sector of our economy. And second, wages and inequality. I think the food desert thing that's been coming up a bunch lately is really telling.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of focus on, like, oh, how can we get grocery stores into these poor neighborhoods?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems kind of a red herring to me. Because when you look at it, and all the studies show that if people in those neighborhoods had the income, mm-hmm. grocery stores would locate there.
Yeah.
So it's really at fundamental base, it's a question of wages and inequality, not about city planning.
Yeah, we never really look at the underlying cause of problems.
Yeah, and this is something we shouldn't feel alone in, because really the history of white bread and battles over white bread show that this is a trap that food reformers have fallen in over and over
mm-hmm.
again.
Well, I think it's so important that you presented the history, because I'm one of those people who have read the books and seen the documentaries, and I'm a part of this movement and conversation. But the history really gave me some good perspective, and I thought it was amusing because I was reading your book this past week when I was in Costa Rica, and I was mixing a lot with gringos who have mm-hmm. left the United States to live a different kind of life in Costa Rica, and many of them were talking about all kinds of conspiracy theories that were formed by the government and how, you know, we have to really be wary and the whole system's going to fall apart, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, reading this history, I understood to a certain degree how we got to this place. And you know, I understand that we're all a part of how it got here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's not some crazy conspiracy theory. It's it's history, and there are lots of reasons why white bread came to where it to its prevalence, because you mentioned in the early 1900s, the late 1800s, there were all of these hygienic issues, and people started mass producing food, and there weren't regulations, and there were all kinds of problems related to using poor quality materials and dirty conditions, and we needed regulation for that. And as a result, white bread appeared.
Yeah, it's a. I mean, that story really gets at the kind of that one thing I'm trying to, in this sympathetic yet critical look at food reformers, I'm trying to show that there's always this ambiguity and unintended outcomes when we try to change the food system, something that we need to be more aware of. And the story, the early story of industrial white bread is perfect for that, because you're right. The industrial white bread, the factory-produced super fluffy loaves, come into our world in the 1910s during a moment of great concern over food safety. You know, is our food safe? Very much like today. In fact, the line, I want to know where my food comes from, the classic locavore question, was actually asked by many, many consumers in the 1900s, 1910s. And what was really interesting is that I found that those anxieties about food cleanliness and bread cleanliness in particular got wrapped up in fears about race and the direction society was heading, and fears about new immigration. It's really interesting. From about the 1880s to the 1920s, roughly, America goes through this, you know, you could call it a moral panic over bread safety. There were, you know, newspaper headlines are reading, you know, germs lurk in your bread. Dangerous bakeries threaten the city. Even mother's bread, bread made at home by mothers, was condemned by many dietary experts as a potential biohazard. And this, you know, there's this fear of contaminated bread, and it's really bizarre to read about it, because I'm looking through all the documents and testimonies, and I can't really find any evidence that bread was actually making anyone sick. So what's going on here, right? And when you look closely at the testimonies and hearings and reports on the bread problem, you realize that it had become impossible to separate food fears about unsafe bread from racial fears about the supposedly dirty, scary immigrants sweating away in small bakeries, as well as kind of gendered and classed anxieties about poor immigrant mothers who were baking bread at home yet wouldn't follow scientific experts' advice about proper modern diet and proper modern child-rearing. And amidst this, you know, gleaming white loaves produced in shining white factories full of stainless steel and beautiful surfaces, that was advertised as bread untouched by human hands, that kind of offered consumers a reassuring sense of safety. These were sleek, edible versions of an industrial utopia.
Well, when I'm around a clean kitchen versus a dirty kitchen, I know which one I would prefer to make my food in.
Right, although I think that we go a little far on the hygiene question sometimes. But the main thing here is the way in which our legitimate fears about food safety, food hygiene, overflow into more social questionable anxieties about people and class and race, and that's something that I think we still very much see today. I try not to do this very much, but sometimes when I write a new magazine article or do a radio interview like this, I'll look at the comments afterwards, and it's amazing. Yeah, not a good idea.
It's amazing to see the
level of acceptable discrimination and vitriol that people are willing to level at people who eat industrial white bread. The scorn, the intensity of feeling that brings up makes me realize that we're talking about way more than taste or health.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate. But back on the sanitary hygienic theme, we have a lot of issues today where we're talking about E. coli and salmonella and listeria and all these things. And we definitely need regulation in food manufacturing and certain standards, because things happen when we start to mass produce anything and ship things.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And I think that's a big lesson of that history regarding bread, is that we have to be very careful about how we we clearly need those food safety legislation. And in fact, the Pure Food movements of the 1900s a tremendous social movement sparked by, among other things, the book The Jungle, and other kind of muckraking reporting about food safety,
mm-hmm.
Really accomplished a lot in terms of the national, the federal food safety laws that are still very much the heart of our food safety law today, as well as lots of state and local food safety laws. And those are really important. But we also have to be careful because they can sometimes end up reinforcing the power of big, concentrated food industry giants when they're applied evenly across the board. And one thing that a lot of the legislation about bread safety ended up favoring the big industrial bread factory and putting the small ones out of business.
Right.
Which, so it's important to think carefully about how we scale our food safety legislation.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I know that you've brought a lot of this information to current day, and I was reading, I think it was last week in the New Yorker, a story about unpasteurized milk with this group in California called Rossum. And I'm a vegan. I personally don't promote any kind of milk consumption, raw, pasteurized, or otherwise. But it's interesting because there seems to be a lot of similarities in the story. People are producing this unpasteurized milk illegally because the rules don't support what they want.
Right.
And it really brings up some interesting questions about do we have the freedom to eat what we want?
Hmm.
And where does that go with protecting and getting food that isn't going to hurt us because it has some... It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the history of the battles over bread shows over and over again that if you focus on, okay, which food should I be eating? Should I be eating the pasteurized milk or the unpasteurized milk? We miss the point.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is to think about what are the economic pressures on consumers and the power relations in the larger industry that allow our food, basically allow a few companies to set the terms of how we eat. And that, I think, is what we need to focus on rather than necessarily the specifics of any particular food choice. There's a great, actually, because since we're so interested in the way that the history of the past is very much present in today, there's a great story, which is Sylvester Graham,
mm-hmm.
who was a major food guru of the 1830s and 1840s. I guess we really only think of him today as because his followers named the Graham cracker after him.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Yes.
But he was actually quite interesting figure. He was probably the father of vegetarianism in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Also had some really interesting... He was one of the very first food reformers to be concerned about the fact that urban folks were losing connection to the production of their food,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to talk about the importance of local agriculture. So he had some really interesting ideas. But what really strikes me in his story is how he became a famous food guru. And it dates to 1831, and he's pretty much an unknown food guru. He goes to New York in the middle of a massive cholera epidemic that's sweeping up and down the East Coast,
mm-hmm.
And primarily affecting poor communities, Irish, African-American communities in New York. But then it's starting to spill over and affect wealthier people as well. And so the wealthier people are, you know, what's going on here? And Sylvester Graham gives a series of speeches about why the poor are getting cholera.
Mm-hmm.
And these speeches are wildly, wildly enthusiastically received by East Coast elites. And basically his speech boils down to... The poor lack the moral backbone to make the right choices about food. They're eating too much white bread, they're eating too much meat, drinking too much alcohol, and therefore, because of their moral depravity, and they're getting cholera as a result, and then that's putting the rest of us into danger. So what we need to do is give the poor more moral fiber by giving them more dietary fiber.
If only that were true.
Yeah, exactly. It's an important kind of proponent of a whole wheat diet, pure water, and fresh local vegetables. And there's, like, that's a nice, you know, I'm all right with that, right? What's wrong with that? But the problem is that he was so wrapped up in his idea that food choice, individual food choice, was the cause of larger social problems and also the way to cure larger social problems, that he misses the root causes of why people in New York were getting cholera. The poor were getting cholera because of grueling conditions in sweatshops and low wages, overcrowding in tenements, the corrupt government's inability to provide sanitation, and also profiteering by vendors of clean water. So basically he took the questions that were really about how we organize the government, how we think about regulation, how we think about the market, and he turned them into questions about individual food choice and this kind of quick and easy, we need to help those people eat differently. And when I read that, I was dumbstruck because I realized that if you substitute obesity for cholera,
mm-hmm.
we're having the same exact conversation today.
And it is all very interesting. I wanted to touch, we just have a few more minutes left. I wanted to mention a few more things that I thought were pretty interesting in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Thiamin, enriching flour with thiamin. That was really interesting to me. And where are we today with that?
That's a huge piece of the industrial white bread story, because by the end of the 1930s, white bread was still very much the shining icon of industrial progress and good citizenship, responsible choices, but there were starting to be all of these critics lining up to attack white bread as being too modern, bereft of nutrients, you know, too pure, too clean. There is a famous saying about how white bread, playing off the old idea that industrial white bread was a pure, safe food. They said white bread is so clean now that even a bug can't live off of it.
There's nothing in it.
Right. There's nothing in it. So there, all these critics were lining up in the 30s, and with the war looming in the horizon, U.S. Military planners were starting to get very concerned about America's ability to fight, because the Depression had inflicted a terrible toll on the nutritional status of the country. People were dying of malnutrition, suffering extreme vitamin deficiency all over the country. As much as we like to romanticize the way Depression era cooks thriftily used real ingredients, it was a bad time nutritionally for the United States. And the military planners were really concerned because they knew that Americans were eating this industrial fluffy white bread three times a day, getting 30% of their daily calories from it, if not more, at that moment. And how are we going to be fit to fight, basically? There's even this moment where war planners are surveying the field of the upcoming war, and they're looking, well, look at the Russians. They eat a hearty rye bread.
Mm-hmm.
And the Germans eat dark bread, and the French eat fluffy white bread, and look what happened to them.
We need to come to the ending of the story, because we just have like a minute or two left.
So anyway, in adding all these synthetic vitamins to white bread saved white bread from itself and restored it to a position of seeming like a patriotic, strong food that can build a body 12 ways.
It's just an amazing story. And that now we're coming back to the importance of whole, minimally processed food. So it'll be interesting what the next 100 years brings us.
Back and forth, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. I recommend this book highly. I really enjoyed it. And anyone that's interested in where we are with food today, this is an important book to read.
Thank you. And thanks for having me on the show.
Okay. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Please go to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, for more helpful information, and have a very delicious week.